My book came out of my dissertation research, but this book was published in February of 2020, which, at least for us in the US, that was about 2 weeks before we went into mandatory lockdown. And I had plans to discuss this book, go on to do some book talks, but then everything closed down. And so I really haven't had a chance to give a formal public talk about the book. So this is my first opportunity, and I really appreciate the invite and the chance to do so. So as Sebastian mentioned, I'll be talking about the book today. I will go through kind of loosely, take a somewhat abstracted look throughout the entire book, or somewhat abstracted talk throughout the entire book. I'll touch on some key moments in the book. I'll begin with a brief story about where the book came from and what inspired me to start investigating this topic. Then I'll discuss a more detailed case study. I'll focus specifically today on the case of Red Hat. And then towards the end, I will also pick up some of the conclusions that I make in the book and about how we can move the commons forward. So with that being said, there we go. So the background for the book, this began specifically during my PhD studies at the University of Oregon. And while I was there, I entered the PhD program wanting to work on a specific topic. And I just sort of realized that there were some other things that were going on that made me want to change my topic a little bit. So a friend in the program, Jeremy Schwartz, invited me to come to the open source convention in Portland, Oregon in 2011. And I was fairly blown away by my experience there, because I went to this large convention hall and all of the attendees were, free software advocates, hackers, open source advocates. And the entire convention hall was full of very large companies. I mean, Facebook, Google, the US government was there, the New York Times, all of these sorts of things. And I was just walking around the exhibition hall, and I would be approached by people who were at the, at their presentation booths or whatever. And they just said, "Hey, welcome. Can I interest you in something over here?" They tried to, pull me in, and they said, "Well, listen, I'll just cut right to it. We're looking for people like you. So if you're interested in a position, if you're interested in a job, why don't you give me a call?" And I found this to be absolutely amazing, because at that point I had no experience with free software. I didn't know how to code. I didn't know how to do this. And I just thought, what is going on at this conference where companies and the government were so eager to recruit people who are interested in free and open source software? Let alone after the event, there was the International Beer Fest was happening in downtown Portland, and you could meet someone from the conference who just had a box full of free drink tokens that were just being handed out. Later that night, there was this catered party on top of a hotel with live music and very sort of swanky spending that was going on and being thrown at this community. And I just felt like there's something going on here, and I want to understand why they're so interested in this this community. So that happened in 2011, and that really sparked my interest in free and open source software. And then in 2012, the following year, the Linux Foundation released its Linux Kernel Development Report. And in that report, there was a very interesting note, and that was that Microsoft appeared as a top contributor to the Linux kernel for the first time ever in its history. That fact is even more stark because Microsoft had a long history of being very antagonistic toward Linux and open source in general. And so if you look at the history of Microsoft and some of even the early days, Steve Jobs had a memo in which he was sort of decrying open source, and it wasn't a sustainable model of development. The former CEO of Microsoft even referred to Linux as a cancer. That, and in that sense, he was talking about the intellectual property licenses that are attached to the software, which would not allow, corporations to be developing software. And also in that same year, Microsoft opened an entire subsidiary of their company called Microsoft Open Technologies that was dedicated to promoting open standards and open source at Microsoft. As a quick note, Microsoft Open Technologies closed in 2015, as the company frames it, they rejoined Microsoft because now that mission is so integral to everything Microsoft is doing that there was it was no longer necessary to have a separate dedicated subsidiary. So there were a few questions that just came up and that really started to guide this research process. Number one, what happened? Like, what changed at Microsoft? Why embrace open source now? That was the initial one. I just wanted to know what, why they had done this totally, 180 degree turn to embrace open source. The second thing was, why are so many companies interested in open source? And in what ways are they contributing to open source projects? As a third question, how do communities of free or libre open source and open source software, so FLOSS, developers negotiate their corporate involvement in their projects? Because at times their interests may align, but at other times they may diverge. And so how do they handle that? And as a related final question, do FLOSS communities have any resource for recourse for unwanted corporate involvement in their projects? So how do they cope with it? What are the strategies or the tactics that they use to avoid such unwanted influence in their projects? So to approach these questions, I draw from the critical political economy of communication, which primarily, as Sebastian said in the intro, focuses on the power relations that mutually constitute the production, distribution, and consumption of communication resources. This comes from Vincent Mosko's book on the political economy of communications. And in that book, Mosko identifies four primary pillars of political economy and what we're concerned with. Number one is history. We want to understand the historical developments, the broad historical changes that have led to the current historical moment. Secondly, we're interested in the social totality. So rather than focusing on discrete individuals or something like that, we try to consider social relations in their entirety and the way that they relate to other institutions and other systems of social practice. Third, political economy is very much driven by some sort of position in moral philosophy. So whatever it is, there are different varieties of political economy, but that an argument is made based on a specific school of thought within moral philosophy. And then finally, we're not concerned just to explain things the way they are, but we really want to work towards praxis and how we can go about, making the changes that we want to see in the world. So to do so, I started drawing from two primary pillars of theory, really. One was related to capitalism, or specifically digital capitalism, and the second was the commons. And I tried to position FLOSS as a site of struggle that was dialectically situated between capital and the commons. And I was very interested in that contradictory relationship and what those contradictions looked like, what were the possibilities, what were the pitfalls of that sort of intersection. And then finally, I was also just very much interested in the commons as an alternative value system emerging from within capitalism. And the possibilities for some sort of post-capitalist society. I'll speak on this a little bit more later, but there already had been people talking about the supposed revolutionary potential at the heart of the commons and how we might try to start building more commons-based resources among us to build some sort of alternative to capitalism. And I think that at least at that point, there was some writing there, and I think we've gotten definitely some more since the time that I started the project, with various types of proposals, in which I have probably one small contribution. But I'll talk a little bit more about those proposals a little bit later. So as Sebastian mentioned, I do approach the book. I look at three detailed case studies. I break them out by three different moments or three different case studies that I think exemplify certain aspects of the dynamics that exist between FLOSS communities and corporations. Number one is Microsoft and that question of what happened at Microsoft. Really what's at play there are the processes of software development. So just as a mode of production, so to speak, like Microsoft had one model of producing software, free and open source software had another one. And basically, Microsoft finally came around to the fact that, yes, this is a highly valuable way to produce software. It can be more robust and more flexible, more secure in a lot of ways. if we start sharing stuff that we're developing rather than holding everything in-house. And you're starting to see that, I think, across a range of businesses and corporations, just a greater willingness to be open with some of the processes that are going on there. I'm not going to discuss the Microsoft case study in detail today. I'm going to focus a little bit more on Red Hat, because Red Hat is probably the exemplary case for how a company can found an entire business model on making money off of software that is all free software. And so I'll explain a little bit of how they do this and how they negotiate their relationship with the free software communities that they rely on for production. The final case study has really everything to do with politics. This was a moment of corporate acquisition when the Oracle Corporation acquired Sun Microsystems. Sun Microsystems had been supporting various open source projects, and then Oracle bought Sun Microsystems, and started to change the dynamic that existed between Oracle and the free software communities. And so I will just briefly touch on that before the conclusion today, because I think talking about the tactics that they took are also instructive for understanding these relationships. I never know how familiar people are with free and open source software, so I thought it would just be very useful to have at least some very basic stuff on the history of Floss, where it comes from, what it is that I'm talking about, and maybe and specifically why this is important. Free software basically has its roots in Richard Stallman's protest against AT&T's proprietary restrictions on the Unix operating system. At that time, he had been working in the artificial intelligence lab at MIT and was working with Unix. And when he tried to work on Unix outside of the lab, he found that he was being denied access to the software. And he thought that this wasn't right, that, you know, I have access to the software. Why shouldn't I have access to this software to work on it? And why shouldn't others, for that matter, have access to work on other software so that everyone can contribute to the software development and to fixing bugs, etc. So he authors the GNU Manifesto in 1985, and that's followed by the creation of what is known as the first copyleft license, the GNU General Public License, which is used to, it's sort of an alternative copyright protection that allows for greater use rather than trapping things within the kind of standard restrictions of copyright protection. Later, he would go on to found the Free Software Foundation, which would be primarily an advocacy organization for free software and why free software is important and why he's taking a sort of ethical stance to protect free software. He sums this up in this famous dictum of his, free as in freedom, not as in free beer. So, you know, it's libre rather than gratis, which, you know, you can avoid that in other languages. But in English, we just have free, and we have this dual meaning of free. So he tries to separate them out in this regard. Later, Linus Torvalds would come and develop the Linux kernel project. This was the ushering in of open source software. Linus really took a pragmatic approach to scaling production on a large scale, specifically software production. His idea was that there, at the time, were a number of different free software projects, but a lot of them were smaller scale, and he thought we could do this on a much larger scale. And indeed, the Linux kernel project now is the largest, it's considered to be the largest software project ever. I've got some more information on that, I think, on the following slide. But Linus was specifically saying that with many eyes, all bugs are shallow. That as if more and more people are looking at the software, they can find bugs in the software, correct those mistakes, and share their contributions with others. So in the end, Floss is simply software for which users can freely study, modify, use, copy, adapt, or distribute, you know, with others. And I think Sebastian also referenced this in the intro, but there are a number of different licenses that are connected to free software. I don't have time to go into all of the differences there, but there are very important differences in some of the protections. I will explain, however, how Red Hat kind of circumvents this problem by controlling some of the licenses that are allowed into their software. So why should we care about Floss? Why does this constitute an important site of study? Number one, we all use Floss every day, whether we realize it or not. Linux now has proven to be such a success that it holds a 100% market share in the supercomputing market. So some of the large supercomputers that are powering the internet itself are all running on Linux. The Linux kernel, here's the information about the Linux kernel project. It's the largest software project ever. There are more than 20,000 contributors. That's according to the most recent Linux kernel development report in 2020. But I couldn't find an exact number of lines of code. So this is still 2017 numbers, but we're talking about 25 million lines of code in the Linux kernel. I would imagine that it has even grown. It tends to grow every year. And that's a substantial undertaking for this large kind of distributed model of software development. Google Android is based on the Linux kernel as well, although it has some proprietary components that are sort of locked behind closed doors. Floss is also being used in high-level military operations and in surveillance tools. So one of the examples I give in the book is there was this naval ship, the USS Zumwalt, which served as an armed floating data center, which is out in the oceans somewhere. And they run various Linux distributions all on the servers that this naval ship is carrying. And of course, very famously, Edward Snowden, in some of his leaked materials, identified XKeyscore, which is the surveillance tool used by the NSA. And that program runs on Red Hat Enterprise Linux, which I'll talk about Red Hat a little bit later. So these tools are being used in, you know, very high level, very sophisticated forms of software. And so I refer to this as this sort of unseen ubiquity of Floss compared to some of the other more visible or internet or social media services. So there's a lot of attention being paid, of course, recently, especially to, you know, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and the rest of them. But free and open source software, you know, in some ways provides some of the technological base upon which a lot of these other services are allowed to operate. So I think it's important to investigate those. There are other major corporations, and I only touched on three within my book, but there are others. Intel, IBM, Google, Facebook, Oracle. Huawei actually appears now as the largest contributor to the Linux kernel project, which is also a very interesting phenomenon just from a kind of geopolitical standpoint. And it's something I haven't really looked into very closely at this point, but I can already say just from a cursory look at some of the forums and things, there at least was some degree of skepticism about why Huawei was being involved. Samsung, NVIDIA, and some of these other companies are involved too. But also we should care about Floss because it is the exemplary case for the coordination of a large-scale distributed production for the creation of and maintenance of the commons. Some of the earlier writings, you know, Yochai Benkler's book on the wealth of networks, really extolled the virtues of what was going on in particularly, you know, free and open source software and why this was something just new and different. And it would have political and economic consequences for the future. Aside from just the production model, there's this corresponding ethic of care for shared resources and the potential for a new subjectivity. This is something that I've also become interested in the book as well, just how working on the commons and having some sort of relationship to a commons resource can actually bring about this new subjectivity in which you care for this source of common wealth. And that can actually place you in a different type of a relationship with your fellow commoners, which differs from, say, when you're working in or when you're competing under, in some other firm under capitalism. So there are contradictory forces at play here, capital and the commons. So this is what I specifically wanted to explore. And so how to deal with these contradictory forces and what potentials exist for social change. So I won't go too in-depth on the theory here. I mean, we can talk about theory, in the question and answer session if you like, but I draw from Marxist economics and critical political economy of communication, digital labor, some of the digital labor debates. These were particularly, there was like a big moment of attention to digital labor, specifically around the 2013 moment. That's right at the time that I would have been working on my dissertation too. So there was this increased attention to digital labor and what we mean by digital labor and the consequences for it. And then also I draw from some of the feminist critiques of Marxism, the ideas of social reproduction to how to actually reproduce one's labor and over time. And then also the attention that was paid to unwaged labor, forms of unwaged labor. This primarily came from the domestic labor that was occurring and that still occurs, and really kind of shining a light on that type of labor. And I think that at least to some degree, the unwaged labor of certain free and open source software developers can be brought to that conversation as well. And then theories of the commons, so commons, common pool resources, and governance, primarily originating in the work of Eleanor Ostrom, who was the first woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize for economics, but very highly regarded for her work on the commons and some of the diverse ways that commons communities exist around the world. Later, Eleanor Ostrom and others would pick up those ideas and focus their attention on the knowledge, the information, or the digital commons. And then from Peter Linebaugh's book, he draws specific attention to the activity of commoning. So, and what that entails and how to, transform the commons into a verb so that they're constantly in a state of becoming, which I found very useful as well. And I already mentioned Yochai Benkler's work in commons-based peer production, but that is in some ways, one of the direct precursors to this and one of the earlier works that started looking at free and open source software as this broader political and economic framework. No need to go through all the details of this slide, but as I was looking for some sort of differentiation or some sort of typology or a way to separate out different theories of the commons, this specifically came out of a trip to London. I had a fellowship at the University of Westminster, which that university also published the book. But while I was there, I was specifically interested in working through some of the different ways that people had theorized the commons. And excuse me, one second. And I found this very useful article by Antonis Brumas, I think his last name is. And he had sort of separated out social democratic theories of the commons and critical theories of the commons. And I found this very useful because I was thinking about how to develop a sort of a critical theory of the commons. And so if you look on the right side of this chart, this is some of the stuff that I'm more interested in. And he that is Brumas, who developed this table, places other theories of the commons on this social democratic theory. And just, you can kind of take a look at this on the way down. And again, I'm happy to talk about this in greater detail later. But specifically, I was interested in this notion of social change and like the commons as an alternative to capitalism. So some of the other theories and proposals for post-capitalism that I draw from is the work of Massimo De Angelis and then Nick Cernicek and Williams. They also have the post-capitalism proposals for the future. So De Angelis' book was, I also read that while I was in London. It was released there. We actually went to a book launch party, a number of the fellows that were in London at the time. And it just came along at the right time because it happened to be exactly what I was thinking about. But De Angelis had worked through or tried to develop some way to theorize a commons circuit of value that would perform the same type of analysis that Marx did for capital accumulation circuits, but would focus his attention on the commons. And I draw from this in the book, and I think this is it's probably one of the most useful ways I've found for thinking about these circuits of value. So in this model here, I don't know if you can see my cursor, but anyways, the commons they're the CS. So the commons are dialectically situated, or they're comprised of an association of commoners who have a relationship to the commons, and then also the sources of their commonwealth. So whatever those sources would be, whether they're material or immaterial. So classically, this could be grassland or lobster fisheries, what Ostrom was talking about. They could also be free and open source software projects. So repositories of code that exist somewhere. So they have those. So those two things comprise, you know, a relationship to the commons. The commons then are reproduced over time through the commoning activity. So C, the small CM in the middle there, which then produce and sustain the commons over time. But then importantly, at the furthest ends of the model here is that the sources of common wealth, so whether those be, again, you know, whether they're software or whether it's knowledge or something, the commonwealth is actually, it has both non-commodity forms and also commodity forms. And this is where, this is sort of the nexus that I was interested in looking at. I was like, how can free software exist at the same time as this non-commodified commons, which continues to be available for everyone, and also exist as a commodity in being sold by companies like Red Hat? And so I found this very useful for thinking about this. There are elements of DeAngelis's argument and the book that I don't agree with, or his approach is somewhat different than the one that I would take, but I really found this to be valuable. So with that being said, let's jump into the, I'll jump into the case study here and describe how Red Hat and why how Red Hat does this, how they negotiate their relationships with the commons. So Red Hat is illustrative of complex relationships existing between corporations and philosophy communities. Red Hat is the largest and only publicly traded company whose business model is entirely based on free software. In other words, basically everything that other companies are buying from Red Hat is freely available. And yet they still pay Red Hat for customized distributions of software. So Red Hat was founded in 1993 with the purpose of developing commercially viable business model for open source. They also had at the time the stated goal of giving back to the open source community. And their interest was trying to sustain it and turn it into something that people could make money and continue to work on open source software. So they held their initial public offering in 1999, and the company tried to list all developers as stockholders, which is, you know, an example of how they tried to really give back to the community. And in fact, it's one of the reasons that Red Hat still maintains a relatively good relationship with amongst the Floss community. So in the end, you know, there were some pragmatic problems with listing all developers of any Red Hat, you know, software as stakeholders or as stockholders. But in the end, they came up with a list of 5,000 people that they wanted to list as stockholders. But then they ran into some of the rules at the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States, which prohibited all but about 1,300 of them from being listed. So in the end, they did list more than 1,000 as stockholders in the company. Anyway, that's sort of an example of how they tried to give back to the community. The other interesting historical note that happened really just as I was sending the book off for publication is that Red Hat was acquired by IBM for $34 billion in 2019. That remains or was and remains IBM's largest ever single acquisition. And now Red Hat operates as an independent subsidiary of IBM. And so I know that Red Hat is still operating somewhat autonomously. I don't know what the relationship looks like between IBM and Red Hat, but I know that IBM specifically is now using Red Hat for some of their cloud computing offerings. That's primarily why they made the acquisition. I'm just not exactly sure what the specific dynamics look like there, because that has changed from the dynamics have changed somewhat from what I described in the book. So Red Hat, during its early years, focused on selling a Red Hat Linux, which was sold on a compact disc for about $50. And this is all based on code protected by the GPL. So all of the software was freely available. But the goal was to provide an easy-to-use distribution of Linux, as well as provide then services and support for the software. They transitioned their business model because in 2003 they found that they were really doing more services and support than really just selling software. So at that point, they divided their offerings into two separate kind of tracks. On the one hand, they started offering Red Hat Enterprise Linux, which is what XKeyscore was built on. And they did so through a subscription model where companies could subscribe to Red Hat Enterprise Linux and then work with Red Hat to get customized distributions of the software that would meet the needs of that of their particular customers. So that was the commodity, really, the subscription that was being offered to other companies. And then the revenues that were generated from Red Hat Enterprise Linux were used to support the Fedora project, which is the free software community that develops software, which can then be used in various installations of Red Hat Enterprise Linux. So the Fedora project is a community-sponsored project which serves somewhat as an incubator for innovation. So people can experiment and build whatever they want in Fedora, but then those pieces can be integrated into the Red Hat Enterprise Linux offerings. So really, the development, the experimentation, and innovation of Fedora can be incorporated into customized distributions of Red Hat Enterprise Linux. So this is where I think it's also useful to focus a little bit more on how Fedora works, because this is really how a community of Floss programmers negotiate their relationship with a corporation that sponsors their work. And things have changed, actually, just as I was preparing to. It looks like things have changed quite a bit. So I'll describe how it worked at the time that I wrote the book and then what it looks like now. So first of all, the governance included the Fedora Project Council, which had 6 to 12 members, including the Fedora Project Leader. And the Fedora Project Leader was appointed by Red Hat and also had veto power on the council. So when I was talking about this, I was like, this is a very interesting arrangement, because you have employees of Red Hat who are serving on the Fedora Council, and furthermore, one of them, the project leader, has veto power. So it really was this different level of power within the community to make decisions. Things have changed now, though. So and this is largely driven by the community, who was pushing for greater changes. So now all voting members on the council can block issues, and the Fedora project leader no longer holds veto power. But the Fedora project leader does have this is how it was described in their charter. The Fedora project leader has a limited power to unstick things if consensus genuinely cannot be reached. There wasn't a lot of discussion about what that means, but could potentially sway certain paths of action from being taken rather than others. And then Fedora also controls contributions to the Fedora project through the Fedora Project Contributor Agreement. And this is what I was referencing earlier, when Fedora originally was allowing lots of different stuff into the project, and they realized that they needed to limit the range of available licenses that could be applied to software in their code base. In part, that is because they wanted to provide assurances to their customers that they could legally defend or be liable for the products that they were producing. So this contributor agreement specifies which type of software licenses are allowed in the software, and it's actually a very limited amount of licenses. And previously, it was the individual contributor licensing agreement, which effectively assigned all copyright for contributions to Red Hat. So again, things have changed a little bit, even since the time that I wrote the book, but it does seem like the community has been able to lobby for a little bit greater power, a little bit more say in what's going on. So the most useful way that I heard this described is describing the Fedora Council, specifically in the Fedora project, as a boundary organization. And boundary organizations are created to negotiate and establish boundaries between two parties who may have both shared and also disparate interests. This comes from O'Mahony and Bechke in 2008. They specifically had done work as well on some free software stuff. So the Fedora project serves as a boundary organization between Fedora and Red Hat. they're the ones that are going to be negotiating that kind of relationship. And as it stands now, actually has a little bit more power than it did when I was writing about it in the book. So recent changes suggest that the power of the Fedora community has actually been honored to some way, or they've been able to win some greater power in their relationship with Red Hat. So then how to understand Red Hat? And this is something that when I first started writing about Red Hat, I was like, well, on the one hand, you could view Red Hat as a pragmatic way of centralizing commons-based peer production and leading to the commercial, you know, a commercial viability of free and open source software, especially at a time when maybe some other clients were less likely to be using free and open source software because they were scared off by a variety of factors. Excuse me. I mean, so on the one hand, they're simply providing commercial access to Floss, employing Floss developers, funneling money back into the community, sponsoring Fedora and the Fedora project, and then also contributing to other Floss projects. So Red Hat as well is another major contributor, for example, to the Linux kernel. So perhaps that's one way to read this, but it's also just kind of classic capitalism. That is, centralizing production, controlling what is included within that production, controlling the types of licenses, controlling worker contributions to the code base, and then also appropriating surplus value through subscription models that provide access to these to Floss production. And so in a way, we could think about this as a commons-based market production. Like, it's everything is based on the commons, and yet they are being marketed and sold through subscription models and service fees, et cetera, to other primarily enterprises in the market. So that's why I thought it was useful to talk about Red Hat and just to look, get a little bit into the details about how that relationship works. I mentioned earlier that I would talk just very briefly about the Sun Microsystems and when Oracle acquired Sun Microsystems and what happened, because that case study, which is described more in detail in the book, really provides evidence of how the community can respond to unwanted influence in their projects. So as I said before, Sun Microsystems supported Floss products. There's three that I discussed in the book. That's MySQL, OpenSolaris, and then OpenOffice. So OpenSolaris was an operating system. OpenOffice is the document production suite, which, I'll describe a little bit more in a bit. But They support these and enjoy a relatively good relationship with those communities that are developing these software. But then Sun is acquired by Oracle. Oracle tried to implement unwelcome changes in otherwise direct development of the Floss projects. Literally, I think one of the ways that they approached the community is they said, well, you no longer work for Sun, you work for us, and here's what you're going to be doing. So here's the development that you're going to be taking on. So in response, all of the communities, the Floss communities, abandoned development on their projects. They just simply left them. It was like it had the equivalent, I kind of framed it as the equivalent of like workers walking out of the factory, walking out of the factory floor and just ceasing production. So in the end, Oracle and its various subsidiaries were left with basically three different like shells of a company, and each one of them had a different fate. But OpenSolaris became discontinued. But now I've seen that Oracle now is launched a proprietary product called Oracle Solaris. So no longer OpenSolaris, but Oracle Solaris, which is a proprietary operating system, presumably based off of the previous production that happened in OpenSolaris. MySQL still continues, but the community forked the project, and this is one of the other key things that can happen, is that they took all of the code because it was still protected under the GPL or another copyleft license, and they just simply copied it and started developing something that is functionally very similar, if not identical to MySQL, and they've started developing MariaDB. And then OpenOffice now has been forked and has become LibreOffice, and that's sponsored now by the Document Foundation in Germany. And LibreOffice is still being developed, and it's actually, I think in a lot of ways, the most widely used document production suite, which comes with, you know, equivalents for all of the Microsoft products, so Microsoft Word and Excel and all of that. So it's, so all of those are being produced by LibreOffice. So in some ways, I think that this represents the community, the power of the community in the face of corporate involvement in their projects, that they do have this power to fork their projects and continue development somewhere else. That being said, one of the persistent issues is the notion of sustainability, like how to sustain that. So in the case of LibreOffice, they got the Document Foundation to sponsor them. Others as well have had, like, there was a MariaDB Foundation or something. So nonprofit foundations to help fund and sustain that over time. But some other projects may be forked and may not ever last that long. So what are the implications then for the lessons learned from these case studies? Number one, I think that the commons paradigm and a lot of thinking about the commons is incredibly beneficial for understanding and trying to understand various types of movements that exist around the world. Number one, it's universal. It can be applied no matter what local context we're looking in. Even though the specific dynamics or the specific characteristics of commons-based movements may differ because they're all being driven from the ground up based on the needs of a particular community, we can look at the ways in which people are still trying to build or protect the commons around the world. And it can apply to a number of different resources, as I talked about earlier, which Ostrom also has written about. It's also adaptable. Like, you can adapt this to various situations around the world. It remains flexible. It's not a prescriptive model for a one-size-fits-all way of organizing. It's basically like, take the key principles of designing and building the commons, and you can implement them in your local community. And then finally, it's also teleological. Like, it points towards this end goal that we have in sight, which is to reclaim the commons and start building more commons resources that can potentially challenge the sort of previously existing structures of capitalism. And yet, commons movements remain localized and subject to persistent pressures. So whether this is the state appropriating or directly intervening in commons-based projects, the market, and sometimes in conjunction. So if you look at some of the deforestation, for example, going on in the Amazon forest, which is being allowed by the Brazilian state, they're starting to, you know, deforest and start to cut into, forests that had previously been held by indigenous people, and the indigenous people are still living there. And then also the notion of sustainability, like how to sustain these things over time. And this is where De Angelis in his book also has this this principle or this idea of boundary commoning. And he specifically refers to this as trying to link commoning activities that connect and sustain commons ecologies over time. He's looking at the margins, at the boundaries. He's actually drawing from systems theory and like cell biology here to show the ways that like cells, like at their borders, can actually start to blend with one another to build something new. And yet links with capital accumulation circuits, as illustrated by the circuit of the commons value, whether willingly or by necessity. What I mean here is that these links continue, that there are certain moments when commons movements will either willingly intersect with capital accumulation circuits, so willingly selling their stuff in order to survive, or by necessity just to survive as well. So the question is how to overcome those contradictions to work toward a broader commons-based society. And this is really, really where I get into some proposals for commons practice, praxis. There's two difficulties here, I think, that need to be overcome. Number one, we have limitations of our existing political and economic institutions. And that is, you know, perhaps a familiar story that existing political and economic institutions predominantly are in the service of capital. They privilege elites. There's hierarchical organizational structures and all of these other things that are antithetical, really, to what the commons is all about. And then the second thing is how to link and sustain commons projects over time so that it may actually provide a critical challenge to capital. And this is what I was trying to think about. And this, as Sebastian mentioned at the beginning, I claim that we need to move beyond a politics of subsistence. So really what I'm talking about here is just the granting of individual rights, open access provisions, like say, yes, you can do that, you can do that. And really start to institute a progressive politics that would actively grow associations and sources of commonwealth. And those two terms there specifically come from that circuit of commons value that, that De Angelis had identified, that we not only need to have greater sources of commonwealth, but then just the way that we associate with one another. So I do have this proposal for what I call subversive commoning. And this is really inspired by some of the ways that Brumas was differentiating between social democratic theories of the commons and critical theories of the commons. And he was specifically talking about subversive stances in the face of broader structures of capital accumulation. So I'm saying here that I think we need to actively begin incorporating resources into commons value circuits and away from capital accumulation circuits. I thought about the quote from David Harvey here, where he refers to capitalism as operating by accumulation by dispossession. And I thought, like, what if we could invert that and reframe it to commons pooling by capital dispossession? So looking at things that already exist out there and trying to actively bring them into circuits of common value. I use the term pooling here specifically because it indicates an opposition to private capital and to like commodification or, you know, dispossession. It's really pooling. It's bringing together shared resources. And then dispossession here, I put it in the book, but it's still an awkward term because, at least as it concerns like the digital commons and the knowledge commons, nothing is really actually dispossessed because there's not really any ownership over, you know, commons, you know, the knowledge commons. So Bowens and Niaros, they have this term called reverse co-optation to describe something very similar to what I'm talking about. So I think included in this framework, if we start thinking about the commons this way, we could think about that. We could look at movements to reclaim farming, housing, forests, or other natural resources as one example of the ways in which people are struggling to reclaim the commons as a common resource. You could also look at the occupation of space or resisting enclosure. So specifically, I'm thinking here about, you may have heard of like people squatting in abandoned housing, but because housing has become so unaffordable, people are saying like, no, this space is not being used. We're going to reclaim this as a housing space. And we could also think about this as even, you know, things like freeing knowledge that is enclosed by publishing firms or held behind paywalls or something else. I would even include in here piracy. So think about Aaron Schwartz and his leaking of JSTOR articles. He set up a server to start scraping articles that were held by JSTOR with the intention, or we don't really know, but at least according to the U.S. government, his intention was to release all of that information and make it freely available. So subversive commoning appropriates resources and reinscribes with the logics of commons value and reinscribes them with the logics of common value, as well as the associated subjectivity that emphasizes things like care, trust, mutual aid, and conviviality. While this is just one proposal, I think we must institute a multifaceted approach to bring about social change. I think we need to remain open to the possibility of new approaches, new opportunities, and new historical contingencies. So for that reason, I just want to make clear at the end that even though I'm arguing for this critical, you know, sort of a critical theory of the commons and something known as subversive commonings, I'm not entirely dismissive of social democratic approaches, policy approaches and trying to institute anything that will help. I think that at times, particularly on the left, I think we get too mired in arguments over differences when really the point is to begin instituting change however we can. And so with that, I will leave it and we can open to questions, and I'm happy to discuss. I'll also just apologize. I woke up feeling a little bit sick this morning, so hopefully there wasn't too much disruption there with some of the coughs and all that. I'll do my best. I'm just feeling a little lightheaded too, so if I'm a little off my game, but I'm happy to engage in conversation. So thank you everyone.
Thank you very much, Benjamin. That was a great, really great presentation, really clear. And the questions that you bring are really, really important. So if people want to ask questions, please write them down. I can start with one, and we can have others after if Christiana wants to have one. The first question I want to ask is about the perception of free software developers and their relation with capital, because you say, for example, the Fedora. Have you asked the Fedora developers what are they answer to the question? Because you were saying, okay, is Fedora or Red Hat a capitalistic classical enterprise, or is it a commons subversive to capital? Have you asked the question to them? Like, do you have make interviews? Because if I understand what you say, maybe what you're trying to say is that to bring a Marxist point of view, there is a class, I don't know how to say it in English, but there is a class en soi, and you want them to be a class pour soi, those people take conscience that they are the same class fighting for capital. And the question is how those people have to think that they are in the same game, you know, working for the same. And I wanted to know if free developers are in that perception or not.
Yeah, that's a great question. For this specific project, I did interviews with some free software, I would say free software activists, rather than specifically with the Fedora project. But that being said, usually when you ask most contributors to free and open source software, they really don't, a lot of them do not have a specific political perspective. Some do, so I don't want to downplay the fact that some do, and some really do take a political stance when they're like in what they're doing. They understand what they're doing as somehow subversive. So there, those communities do exist, but the much more dominant view is simply one of pragmatic and like practicality and just building technical tools that are useful. And so a lot of them just like, you know, either the process of contributing to something like that, or they just want to see, you know, they want to see more free software projects developed because they're just fun or useful, or it's a fun technological tool. I was going to say one other thing about that too, because yes, I've just lost it. And that's what happens when you have a little bit of lightheadedness. But yes. The other thing that happens is another reason that a lot of people contribute to free software is specifically because they're trying to get ahead. They're trying to get a job. So they think like if they contribute to a project and they become well known within the project, it's a way to signal to other employers their skills. So it really is about kind of self-development and developing one's own technical, you know, abilities rather than a specific political project. More likely, the project is just to try to get a job. And so you especially those people who are not paid, they're just volunteering their time. They want to be able to put on a resume or something that, yes, I've also built, you know, I've helped do this, I've done this. So they're just have that sort of instrumental view of just trying to get a position somewhere.
Leah, you have a question. Maybe you can ask it because we are enough for you. If you want to put it, maybe it can be more alive. The discussion can be more alive. So Leah, if you want to talk, or maybe I can ask the question if you want.
Okay, I can talk. Thank you, Ben, for your presentation. Just a question I put in the chat. It was about your notion of subversive. The question was, we understand the scope of your proposal to take the commons out of capitalism, but with what means and consequences when we see to what extent the commons are entangled with capitalism, with the two cases you present, that of Red Hat, but also how you came to this open software community the first time?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with what means and what consequences? Yeah, I really, it's a very good question, actually. I'm thinking about this in maybe some broader ways than your question is asking. But, you know, I think that we need to start finding ways to create, you know, a shared consciousness of like the things in our life. So whether it's free software or whether it's just anything in our community, I maybe it's somewhat romantic, but I think that in some ways we've lost some of that to a certain degree. And there's almost a sensation, at least here and in my experience, a sense of isolation to some degree. And so ways that we can find to come together to actually work on something that will benefit all of us in our communities, I think that's a project that's worth instituting, right? The broader goal, of course, is to really start to change social relations writ large, the way that we relate to one another socially, to start getting people out of this mindset of scarcity, right? That there's not enough, and that we can actually start building things that will be sustainable and that can benefit our local communities over time. I'm thinking here just also about very basic things. So, sharing meals with friends, doing some sort of meal sharing. That event, that moment is very nice, right? So maybe I make dinner for someone, and then my friends will share food with me. Getting food from my local farmers or something like that. I think all of those have value. And it's sort of outside of capital to a certain degree. Yes, we have to purchase, the food or whatever. Actually, I just saw your follow-up here. So you say you're agreeing with the objective, so the ambition, the need. So the only concern is how. Maybe one of the more optimistic ways to look at this is I think that we all engage in commoning activities a lot of times. Like, I think that there are very small micro places where we share without, the expectation that there would be some return or some sort of payment or something like that. And so I think just scaling this up to a broader kind of social project is really what I'm getting at. So how? That's sort of the thing, is like trying to link these movements to something. So whether that's a local organization also partnering with another local commons organization elsewhere, or a regional one, a national one, to some degree, to just start sharing resources that way. I think one of the more interesting things about digital commons is that they can be distributed, across the world, basically, and be used in creative ways. So that's one of the things that I'm thinking about, and maybe I don't have the perfect answer, but I agree with your question of how as well.
My name is Eliana. Thank you for the presentation. It's really, for me, it's a very interesting topic, not only because I am trying to research on these things also, but also because I'm an activist. I'm a free software activist in Bolivia. And I was wondering about, the structure and the way that the community works with different corporations. And as I understand, I put it in the chat, I understand one of your concerns is this, what you found in the community, in the free software community, it's a way like to participate in the governance of commons. And you claim that it's possible perhaps to find a model there in which civil society can participate for claiming or for at least participating in the governance of other commons, as I understand. And it's a great topic for research. But my concern, and it's not about research, it's more from my activist point of view, is if this participation of the people claiming or participating in the governance of different commons would be or will invite like massive participation of a lot of people, or we are thinking about an elitarian civil society. You know, I don't know if I can communicate my idea, because I'm also working in different projects, for example, now in disinformation, and I think disinformation is also a problem of commons. And there, again, one of the solution is the participation of people, but again, is only some groups of this civil society can participate, because it's a very difficult thing to understand, and the people who want to participate have to study to participate in the processes, and they have to dedicate some time also. So it's about the my question is about the composition of this civil society, these people participating in the processes.
I will say that I do cover some of the other proposals for maybe how this could be done a little bit in some of the conclusion parts of the book, but because there are a number of different proposals here for how we can do this, or what the dangers are specifically, or like how to facilitate this on a local level, like just talking about how to get people to participate in civil society. And yeah, it's just a very difficult question. But I think one of the things that at least the commons teaches us is that, you know, the origins of the commons research was really to find a way outside of either the market or the state and to develop communities, right? So Ostrom's work was really sort of grounded in the concerns of, you know, how to develop. It was all about development economics. So, and around that time, the two primary ways that at least governments were saying that people could be developed, right, was through instituting market relations or through state provision. And Ostrom said, well, actually, no, if you look at the way that people actually live their lives on the ground, they're doing lots of things outside of the market or outside of the state to take care of themselves, their community, and other people that are there. And we need to facilitate, we need to allow for that type of livelihood, that type of life to continue. So, you know, there's this danger of, you know, earlier when I was saying we need to link commons movements and we need to do this, inevitably we'll run up against existing structures like of the state or something like that, or existing policies that you know govern, you know, various national jurisdictions or whatever. But I do think there are some really interesting movements that are happening for people to have at least their being recognized by the state, to say like, okay, there's this community, they're doing what they want, and we need to institute some way to protect what they are doing, because it has value, and it, you know, they don't want us to be involved in their lives. So I guess this is maybe a rambling way of saying that I think that the needs of any particular local community should be driven by that community, right? And that they should be able to establish the boundaries for their community. So if they don't want, you know, other people to be coming in or something like that, then they should be able to have that right. But my concern is more about this idea of just relations, you know, and trying to change the relations, the way we relate to one another. So I feel somewhat unsatisfied with my response, but it's just a really good question, and it's something that I'll have to continue thinking about. So thank you for that.
You say that state can help, right? Have you seen some public policies that helped the commons to keep the value of the commons inside themselves? And a second question that I have is that you talk about communities, right? But the problem is that sometimes communities are closed. That's what Michel Bowen says, that you can have a, sorry for the light, you can have a cooperative that generate value, that keep it for the cooperative, but the cooperative can be selfish for themselves. And so the question is, how can we invent a new form of cooperation where the value is not only kept inside the cooperative, but be given to all, but not given to the capital? Because that's a problem. How do you open things to everyone, but not to the capital? What are the license? Or so there are two questions, right?
That's the difficult question. I mean, all of these are difficult questions, because I think in a lot of ways, we're still thinking through these kind of contradictions or these things. So what's to prevent, you know, I've thought about this specifically in the US context, where we have, you know, especially rural communities who specifically do not want to be seen or to have anything to do with the state, right? Whether it's the state government or the federal state or anything else. And they eventually, if they were allowed to have a commons, it might be very exclusionary, not just of having people to benefit from, you know, whatever they're producing. So if there's farmers in, you know, Eastern Nevada where I am or something like that, but they might just say, no, we don't want, you know, it might become a very exclusive community, right? And be very racist. It might just want people out, right? They might try to kick other people out. And this is where I think it's somewhat, you know, we have to be careful about what we're proposing and how we're proposing it. But this is where I like at least the foundational sort of ethic that's at the heart of some of the things that I think DeAngelis identified, those things of trust. That's one thing. And yes, certainly an exclusionary community can trust everyone in the community, but still not trust everyone, right? Like, I want to keep some people out. Mutual aid, that we should be caring for one another and providing for one another. Care, just the work of care, that sort of hard, difficult work of caring for other people. You know, I think as long as there's remains some sort of, you know, ethical principles behind what it is we're trying to do, then it may not be co-opted in a way that becomes too exclusionary. And I don't know how you enforce that or whether we even should be trying to enforce that, but I think that's what we need to continue talking about and what we mean when we're talking about the commons.
For example, that was that question with Decidim. It's one of my case study. Decidim is a platform for democracy. So it was developed by Barcelona, and now they have an association. So they had a hybridation between commons and the state. Anyway, and they had that issue that they have free software, but they didn't want that free software be used by not capital, but states that are authoritarian. They didn't want the platform democracy to be used. So they tried to do a social contract, but it was it's not mandatory. The only people that have to respect the social contract are the people that signed the social contract. So it's kind of a way, but not strong enough to prevent some states to use the common. I will ask the question of Alexandre, or maybe Christina, will you want to?
First of all, thank you, Benjamin, for the great talk. It's really inspiring. I just wanted to link maybe with a comment to Leah's questions before, because I'm currently researching also on the cultural commons, in particular in the digital world. And I totally, you know, by your position of, you know, trying to add information into pulling information in the commons and take it away from the capitalists. But there is also the element of reluctance, which is to some extent also connected to what Sebastian was also saying, of these communities that are so much used to, you know, perceive everything in a capitalistic perspective, that, you know, the shifting of the paradigm, it's going to, you know, what are the means that might be needed, and how to make this paradigm shifting. This is something that is really concerning me, that I was talking about a cultural commons, but it applies also for different kind of, you know, communities, I was expecting. So So that was, and I, if I remember it correctly, this reluctance element is a remark that I made last year to Michael Bowen. So every year I keep having the same remark, same concern. So apart from my comments, there's Alexandre Oquet that asked the questions, but he does not have a mic. So he's asking governance changes. Sorry. But are the governance changes when a fork such as the ones that happened after the Oracle takeover? If you do you have any hints about what happened there? As for some example of governance nightmares that may happen in FLOSS projects?
Yeah, so this is specifically, if I'm also understanding this correctly, you're specifically asking about how the community itself copes. I mean, aside from any influence from capital, but like what happens within the community and how do they change their governance structure in that regard? Yes. Yeah, and this one will, there are other examples too where projects have just broken down because they haven't had people buy in to whatever the new forked project is going to be or however it's going to be run. And this is one of the things that I think I maybe I could have done a better job of really highlighting just the disruptiveness of, you know, in that example, you know, the corporate takeover, because it does disrupt the projects, and other projects have had this fate too. And then it really just depends on the community or elements of the community to pick up the work and to continue on the work and to do it in a way that is going to be productive for the software. I've found, at least in my experience, that most of the communities are still going to have an element of the community that is interested in maintaining the project. The question then becomes how, right? How, like, do we get a nonprofit? Do we reach out to help, you know, and all of these things. But then there are often really difficult conversations that happen between the community as they're working through those, that disruption. And so there, again, there's not really like a one size fits all for this, but it sort of depends on the community to try to maintain the project over time and to develop either the same governance structure that worked well for them at their previous sponsor, or to develop one that is going to work going forward. So yeah, it's a difficult and very good question. And also, Christiana, just as long as I was thinking about your comment a little bit too, I feel this sort of urgency to want things to change, and I constantly do. But in the book, I also draw from some of the work of Raymond Williams, for example. And one of the things I keep going back to is his idea of the long revolution. And I've kind of used this as like, it helps me at least to get through, as like, things change, but they change slowly. And they do. Like right now, we're in this moment where we have emergent forms of value creation, emergent forms of culture, emergent forms of being in the world. And that's all, it's always going to brush up against and conflict with some of the stuff like the dominant culture, right? And I think even going forward, quite frankly, I've also been really inspired by some of this, like, there's been some science fiction that I've at least been reading recently, which is like, let's just say we get rid of capitalism. I don't actually think we're going to get rid of it. This is Kim Stanley Robinson's book. I think it's called 2000. I forget the year, but he projects out like 150 years into the future instead of like, you know, 10 years or hundreds of years. And he says, you could very clearly imagine a world where, like, capitalism, let's just say we've gotten rid of it, but it's not totally gone. There's going to be residual elements of capitalism. So he positions it almost like as if it's been relegated to like a, like casino games. Like, it's just something you play if you want to, but you don't have to. And I think that is, I've just found that, like, I kind of smile when I read that, because it's much more realistic than, you know, some sort of radical immediate change that's going to happen. I think that this is some of the things that we're working through now. So, and
to go on that, Michel Bowens usually used the example of the capitalism, and he showed that capitalism, to be dominant, took like 200 or 300 years to go from aristocratic society to capitalist society. It started from small cities, and then it started to grow. And he say it's the same for commons. We should do a slow revolution.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe if you have some concluding words, because we are arriving at the end of the discussion.
Yeah, I guess I'll just say, I see Stefan here also said that the source code is on GitHub for Decidium and all instances are deployed on AWS. And this is one of the things that's happening. So I even mentioned my, IBM acquiring Red Hat. Microsoft acquired GitHub after I wrote the book as well. And so I think if anything else, it sort of reinforces my point of corporate acquisition, centralization, and the potential dangers that are facing a lot of these platforms and a lot of the communities and how they might think about coping. So one of the other things I think that I've tried to do, we're often, very small voices, at least in, for example, at my institution. I've also thought that, for example, universities, public institutions should be using free and open source software. And I think that it would be an amazing way to start supporting them, to actually have them as public resources and supported publicly, rather than being in the hands of the IBMs and the Microsofts and everything else like that. I think it makes a lot of sense, but it's just a question of how to do it, where to locate them, and do some of these things as well. So again, thank you everyone for coming. This has been a real joy, and I'm happy. This is a great conversation afterwards. And like I said, this is one of the few opportunities I've got to discuss the book in public. So I really, really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.